Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 19th, 1999. In the Creekside room this afternoon is Vicki Arndt. Today's session is number 99.5 and is titled Faith, Money, and Emotions. Let's listen in.
Vicki Arndt, and I am a financial advisor by profession. And today we're going to be talking about emotions and money. And faith, all three together. And it's been very interesting for me since I've been here in the village because financial issues are really a huge issue for all of us. I mean, if you have a lot of money, then of course you're concerned about whether you're managing it properly. If you don't have any, you're concerned about the potential to get more and hopefully to live a reasonable life. And if you're like most of us who have sort of something in between, you have your issues as well. And what I've observed in my practice is that people, I can give you all the sound advice in the world based upon analytical or statistical information. But that's probably, people make decisions not even 50% of the time on that information. Because what it does is filter through what we bring to the table. And each of us brings something to the table with regard to money. And I believe much of it is because of our upbringing. I grew up in a family where my father and mother both had been Depression children. And so I have the stories of how poor they were. And my mother went to a Catholic school, and she had two outfits, and she'd wear one and wash one, you know. And I remember she had a sister that she was really... just never was close to her whole life, and her sister used to take her stuff. And that just made her crazy because she didn't have that much stuff for her sister to be taking it and putting her yucky body odor on her stuff. And so I think that, and then my father, on the other hand, grew up as well not having nothing and then was able to really have a very great career and really a self-made person, so I have tremendous admiration for him. But because of that, he's brought to the table, I think of my father now at 75 almost, my dad has plenty of money and he will never have enough money. He will never have enough money. For him, that feeling of being financially insecure has driven him into his life in a way that has really probably made his life in some ways. And I remember, my mother died many years ago, but I remember my father when bill paying day would come, and my mother would have used the charge card at the department store, and my father would say, "What is this bill about?" And so my mother used to save some of the grocery money so that she could buy stuff on the side, right, and not tell my dad. So that's kind of the dynamic I grew up in, and what's interesting, there's my sister and myself, and I grew up always being really pretty frugal in a certain context. I mean, I wouldn't call myself overly frugal, but I would call myself conservative with regard to money. And my sister never had any money. No matter how much money she has, she never has any. So it completely manifested itself in different ways for us. Of course, we're different people. So the issue of money and emotions is huge. The other issue that comes into the play, particularly at Holden Village, is the issue of faith. I've had lots and lots of conversations with people in the village, spontaneous conversations, and they have been very, very powerful conversations and enlightening for me in a lot of ways, because I know that in my faith, I have struggled with the issue of money as well. I think all Christians do, or all people of faith, whether you're Christian or non-Christian, I think you deal with the issue of money because our concept is sort of the St. Francis of Assisi or the Mother Teresa, that those people are truly virtuous. And that I am not as virtuous because I have material wealth. And I don't mean wealth in the context of really, really lots of money, but all of us in this room are more wealthy than many, many people in the world. We certainly have a lot more. So dealing with that as a Christian is a huge challenge for us. And my admonition to every single person who I speak with is, you have to find that within yourself. It's not my job or anyone's job to tell you exactly how to deal with that in your life. And we really, frankly, don't have a model. All the references in the Bible to money are negative. Money changers. The root of money is all. The money is the root of all evil. Or actually, it's not. We've paraphrased it that way. It's the love of money is the root of all evil. And it's all about, you know, people who collect taxes, and they're bad, and everybody's bad. But keep in mind, and actually one of the theologians here, Deanne Lagerquist, who's speaking tomorrow, shared with me was that in the Bible, they didn't have a money economy. They had a barter economy. When the Bible was written, it was, I'll trade you two goats for a pig, you know, that kind of thing. We don't have that anymore, obviously. Our trade vehicle is money. So money is a huge issue for all of us. Probably one of the greatest reasons for divorce in our world is money. If all of us are honest, we will say that we argue with our spouse about money. Maybe some less than others. There was a woman in my class yesterday who said she was written up in Money Magazine, she and her husband, for arguing about money a tremendous amount. There's a big article on them. It's a hallmark of your life, you know, to have that. But it's a huge issue for all of us. And then our churches are very shy about money. You know, the only time they talk about money is during the stewardship campaign or the building campaign. And then, of course, they don't do it necessarily with a whole lot of finesse. And so then people end up getting upset. And so it's this conundrum that we have where we're really not ever in a situation where someone's saying to us, it's really okay. It's really okay to want to be financially secure. And that's the message that I have been sharing in the context of our faith. That it is really okay to want that. And there's nothing wrong with wanting. We've talked about wants and needs. I do believe that once your needs are met, there are certain wants that we should be able to have in our lives to bring us to a place where we can have, as an example, a roof over our head for our family. Is there anything wrong with wanting a home? Well, I don't think so. I mean, I'm giving you my bias, my personal opinion, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Where we have trouble is where our wants become tremendous, and that's what leads to debt. And that's what leads to problem because we're living well beyond our means. I wanted to talk today about reasons why I think people don't have what I call financial independence. And that means something different to every one of you in this room. And I could actually ask all of you and you'd shout, oh, it means being able to retire and not have to worry. Not running out of money. It means being able to put my kids through school. It means being able to pay my mortgage and not have to worry about it. I mean, there's a lot of things that there are a lot of definitions of financial independence, and actually for every person in this room, it's different. And that's another message that's really important. We tend to want to try to find the what I call the rules of thumb. You know, we all feel better knowing that we're labeled somehow. You know, that makes me feel better. I'm in the in crowd. And you know, I belong to this church, or I'm in this kind of profession. And the reality is that every single one of us is completely different. I've never, ever worked with clients where their situation was identical, ever. And I've worked with a lot of clients. So now that you've got an ice cream, we can go ahead and start.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
No problem. Okay. And she didn't buy any for the rest of us.
I gave money away to kids, though.
Oh, well. Then you are more virtuous than the rest of us.
Thank you.
I had a very interesting conversation this week with a woman who is, she's a person who, she and her husband, their entire lives have really lived a life of service. They're not pastors, they're lay people, but he was arrested for protesting years ago, you know that, and they've been very, very committed and very determined about their life of service. They lived within a community, like Holden Village, only I'm not sure which community, but another community where you actually do live there and you contribute like a commune, more like a commune though, not really. And they currently are doing that in another area. But her husband belongs to a family where they had a family business. And this family business is quite successful. Well, guess what? All of a sudden, they have a lot of money. And the conversation was interesting to me because the whole concern was somehow I will be really, bottom line, less virtuous with this money than I am without it. And I found that very curious because I don't think that the money is what makes you non-virtuous. I think it's your perception of money, possibly the way you live in your community and model things in your community and give within your community. But it isn't money, and we put this power into money that is so ridiculous. But we all have it, every person in this room has some sort of something with regard to money. My issue as I was growing up was my parents had done very well, and so their network of people were the people in the community who were the movers and the shakers kind of people, and so I saw a lot of people come through my life who seemed very unhappy. So I associated money with a lot of money with unhappiness. Now, is that logical? No. It was my association by observation, but it certainly isn't true. On the other hand, that can money bring you happiness? No, I don't believe that. I think that you have the opportunity to do certain things with money that you wouldn't otherwise have. So I had the conversation with this woman was, if you don't want all this money, give it away, but give it away then in a way that is it being a good steward. If you do not make decisions about this money, then you are not being a good steward of this money and this gift that was given to you. It was given to you. It wasn't given to someone else, and there's a reason why it was given to you. So think hard about what you'd like to do with this money, and then manage it in such a way that you really can make a difference for people. Really make a difference. These are the kind of conversations that I encourage you to have while you're here as well with one another. We will talk about our sex lives before we will talk about money. You will hear in the community this week that someone was sexually abused or that they had this or that, but you know what? You will not hear someone say how much money they make in the village this week. It's not going to happen. It's the last taboo. I really believe that. It's the last societal taboo. And why is that?
Value.
What?
Value. Personal value.
It may be that we're placing way too much value on it. You know, and certainly it's a fear. It's a fear that motivates us to place that value on it. Because you know, even people who have a lot of wealth, their greatest fear is that they're going to lose it all. That's their greatest fear. I think of my dad. My dad has plenty of money. He'll never have enough money. In his mind, he will never have enough money because he had that modeling and he had that place as a child where he didn't have enough money. And so for him, the more money he has, I think intellectually he understands that he's secure, but emotionally he doesn't. And so I think our challenge as Christians is to break that mold. Is to break that model and to say, I am not going to be a slave, really. I am not going to be motivated by this fear any longer. I'm going to accept that this money's coming to me and I'm going to make a big difference in the world with it and I'm going to be grateful for the opportunity. Or I am going to be a good steward of the little that I have and make it grow more so that I can pass it on to my kids or my grandkids or a charity. We're going to talk about estate planning on Thursday, so we'll talk about those kinds of opportunities. But that's our challenge. And Holden is a great place to spend some time thinking about it because it's the only place I have in my life where I can actually think without having to worry about what I'm going to eat, whether the kids have their lunch packed tomorrow, who's got their homework to do, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, managing the TV time and so on. Any questions? I really want this to be, I don't want to do all the talking. In fact, originally I'd asked that this session not be taped and because I wanted very much for us to have the opportunity to have conversations. So I still want that. I was informed we have to tape it, so that's fine. But I really want very much for us this to be interactive. So I'm going to open the discussion up now and I'm going to encourage you to have some conversation. Here are the reasons that I came up with why we don't achieve financial independence. And number one in my mind, procrastination. You know what? I'm going to do something else today, or I'm not going to think about it. This is too hard. Every excuse in the world. I don't understand money. I'm really just not that good at it. Or I don't have, you know, there's 1,000 reasons. Number one. More money is lost through indecision than by making a bad decision. So I always tell my clients we're better off making lots of bad decisions than we are making no decisions. That's supposed to be a joke. Anyway. So procrastination is a huge issue. And I'm sure, though you don't want to raise your hands and admit it to everybody else, I'm sure someone in this room, along with me at times, procrastinates. Not only on money decisions, but other decisions. Of course, we're talking about money right now. But those decisions cost you a tremendous amount of opportunity. And again, I'm a firm believer within the context of our faith that we have been given what we've been given. Yes, we've worked for it, but I also believe that God guides our life. If you ask God to guide your life, God guides your life. And so I am doing what I am doing for a very particular reason. I can't know all the reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing. I know many of them. And every day, more unfold to me. But if I procrastinated I think about the context of it, the only thing I can materially change, if I ask God to guide my life, and I believe that God guides my life, the only thing I'm ever going to change is the time frame on that. What's going to happen is going to happen. I may be able, by my own will, to change the time frame, either make it longer or shorter, but ultimately I will end up where I'm supposed to be. And so procrastination is a huge issue for us. We put up this obstacle. And why do we procrastinate? My belief is we procrastinate because of fear. Who would like to share with us a fear they have about money? If you can get in touch with that at all. It's a hard thing to get in touch with because we don't think about it.
I'm fearful of being poor because I grew up poor.
Okay. You're fearful. You know, it's interesting that you say that. It manifests itself. My husband grew up very poor, and he has no fear about money. Mm-hmm. I've been there. I've lived that way. I can live that way again. Mm-hmm. So it manifests itself in very different ways for different people. But the fear of being without motivates you. Mm-hmm. How does it motivate you? To work harder?
Yeah. Strive for lots of education.
Okay.
And yes, I think I work hard. I certainly don't work harder than my parents did. But they did, things just didn't come to fruition for them.
Right.
They did. I guess what motivated me more than anything is having two children and not wanting them to grow up the way we did.
Right. Right.
So I worked hard.
Okay. So fear is often a catalyst for us. But fear can also be something that stops us dead in our tracks and keeps us from doing anything. And it can be manifested in both ways. And it also, I mean, my fear about money sometimes really motivates me and sometimes it stops me. So I go in and out. You know, I have this wave of where I'm very, very motivated and very afraid. You know, the fear stops me. Anybody else? Fear of being poor, yeah.
I think for me it was fear of making a bad decision. My money was somewhere where I thought it was okay. And so I was afraid to do anything with it because I was afraid I would lose it or something. So I don't really care if I have money or not, but it's there. I need to do something with it. So I've recently done something with it. I think it's a good decision, like you were saying. I turned it over to somebody and said, do something. And now I just feel so much more relaxed. I don't feel nervous about it, you know.
So your decision was to get help.
Yeah.
Which I think is a very...
I procrastinated for a long time.
Yeah. And getting help, I mean, somehow we're in a world, you know, we should all be able to do everything. I should be able to build my own house because I'm that smart and that talented that I should be able to build my own house. I should be able to, you know, grow a garden and do all my own gardening and compost in my backyard and all these wonderful things. But guess what? I need help. I can't do it all and be a mom and be a wife and be a professional person and be all the things that are expected of me. So I have to accept that I need help on certain things. Okay, that's really an important thing. What other fears do we have related to money? Anybody else?
I think for me, I'm single and I don't have children, and so I don't have family, so there's nobody else to fall on to help me out.
Okay, so there is no safety net for you. No safety net. It's me or it's nobody.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, that fear is motivating you in a certain context to understand that about yourself and to make those decisions for yourself. How about some of us who haven't made any decisions? What's that about? Is there anybody here who hasn't really dealt with the issue of money or made the decisions? Mm-hmm. Anybody that they're willing to share? I'm sure someone has. Okay, that's fine. Well, I meet with people who have been procrastinating for many, many years. And what's really fun about those people, first of all, what's real fun about them is that they're very conservative, of course. They've got all their money sitting in, you know, CDs or less, savings accounts. I've seen a lot of savings accounts earning 2%. Thank you very much. And then we move their money into conservative stock portfolios or mutual funds or something, and then after about a year what happens is the light bulb goes on and all of a sudden they become like horse racers. You know, they're like, oh well, let's do this and let's do this and let's do this, and then my real work comes in because I have to tone that down and help pull back the reins and say, you know what, wait a minute, wait a minute. your risk tolerance hasn't changed that much, and let's go through it again. You know, we go through the scenario, your risk, and then they realize, oh yeah, you're right. But they get kind of caught up, you know, especially in the last 5 years with the market has been phenomenal, continues to be phenomenal. I've talked to more people this week who said, I pulled my money out last fall. Boy, was that a mistake. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it probably was. But when do you get back in? So now they're procrastinating. They don't want to get back in until it goes down again. Guess what? I don't think it's going down again. So you better get back in, mm-hmm. You know. Okay. So we all have fears. There are other fears. You know, people who have a lot of money fear that they're going to lose it. People who have no money fear that they're going to never have any. I mean, again, we're motivated by this. Another reason people, and this is huge if you're in a relationship, conflict. Conflict. The lady who was written up in Money Magazine, you know, because she and her husband argued about money, there was a couple last week who sat in the front row every day, and the first session I did last week was on goal setting. And you know, you got to set goals with your financial goals and so on and so forth. So the next day they came in and they said, the husband came in ahead of his wife, and he said, do you think a car should be a goal? I said, yeah, I do. It's a significant amount of money, and if you want to pay cash for it, you can now plan that in 5 years I'm going to need a car, and that then I'm going to purchase it and pay cash for it rather than going into debt. To me, that makes sense. He goes, oh, I'm so glad you said that. My wife and I fought for an hour last night about this, and she didn't agree with me, and he was just really excited and waiting for his wife to come in, you know, so I could give her the old 1-2. And throughout the week, they kept kind of keeping me updated on the round of their conversations. The next day they came in and he said, you know what? He said, this whole goal setting thing is very powerful because we had a conversation about a particular thing and we couldn't have been in more opposite. We were completely thinking about this situation differently. And I'm so glad we had the conversation. Well, if you don't go through the process of having the conversation, then of course you can't come to a mutual place. And that conversation is not something you have one time. That conversation is something you have often. Because it doesn't take long before, you know, you just think about it. You know, you have a conversation. My husband and I, we plan out our day, and then pretty soon, I don't know what happens, but we knew what we were supposed to be, but someone's not there. It happens all the time, so quickly. Where you have it all together, and then all of a sudden, you're off somewhere else. That's really true with our financial goals. You want to be able to retire. You know, my husband and I have an age difference, an 11-year age difference, so we're going to be retiring. I'm going to probably retire earlier than I would like because of that. I don't want him to be 110 and then we try to do our traveling, you know. So we that's a different situation, a different scenario. But we had to have a conversation about that. How long do you want to work? And I had to make a compromise. You know, I think maybe I'll have my practice and be able to still do it, but I want to have the flexibility to travel and do the things that we want to do, you know, toward the twilight years of our life. So conflict is a huge issue. The other conflicts we have are with our family, our parents. Probably many of you in this room have not had conversations with your parents about their money because it sounds really greedy, it sounds really cheesy, it sounds like you're trying to get something, and I understand that. I really understand that. My father is one of my clients. The hardest client I have is my dad. He asked me to pick some stocks for him, so I did research, and my dad is very analytic. I did all this research, and I sent the stuff to him, and then we had a conversation, and he started arguing with me. Well, why this? Why that? Why this? Why that? And I just said, Dad, you asked me for my advice. I've given you my advice. You don't have to agree with me, and I'm okay with that. If you decide to do something totally different, that's fine, but I'm not going to argue with you. I've already given you what I believe is to be right. And there's silence, and then he said, do what you think is best. So that conflict with family can be huge. And guess what? I don't know as a child how to say, I can say it now because I'm in the business I'm in, but as a child, to say to my parents, Mom, Dad, the most loving thing you can do for me is to get your affairs in order before you die. It just sounds so self-serving, and in a way it is, because estate planning and dealing with our affairs is not about the people who are alive, for the most part. It's about who they're going to give this money to. But nightmare after story after nightmare after story of people having to deal with Mom and Dad at their death and the problems and the agony and the time, you know what? That it's not okay. It's not okay. And to have the conversation with parents, if you can do it, is really, really appropriate and really important. Just to say to them, I want to be a partner with you, I want to help you. What happens to parents is they feel, particularly as they get older, that they're losing control. And that's a really scary place to be. So those kinds of questions really have to happen before someone, my belief is before they get into their 80s. The best time to have that conversation is when your parents are in their 60s and 70s, because the end of their life is not so imminent. And they are dealing with other issues that we can't know because we're not there. There must be a tremendous amount of anguish in a certain way that people go through when they think, I'm still really sharp here, my body's giving out, I know it is, and I really don't want to go from this place. I like it here. You know, I want to see my grandkids do this or whatever. So having that conversation, so conflict's a huge issue for us in all kinds of ways, and it keeps us from doing anything. I'm not going to have a conversation with my dad because I know he's going to drill me. Well, that's his choice, but I still can have the conversation. Questions about that? Okay. The other thing that I see a lot is just plain old ignorance. And see, these are all emotional outlets. You know, again, I don't know anything about this. And women do this worse than men do. Men have had to learn about money, because it has been their job and their role. Women, and my husband, this makes him crazy because he doesn't think this should be the case and he won't let me get away with it. But women have had the luxury of saying, I don't need to be involved with this. My husband can make the decisions. Well, you know what? I don't know about the gentleman in this room, but I would suspect that sometimes it would be really, really nice to have help with it.
I think it's changing. In our case, I don't know anything about it.
Okay.
Well, I just have
so you're the ignorant one.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I have an ATM card, and I just know there's money there. Okay. She takes care of everything.
Okay. So you're the lucky one in your family. That's how my family is too. My husband's the lucky one, right? But see, in another context, and it is, I think more and more that's becoming, there is, it's not necessarily that women are doing it, but that there's been a decision in the family who's doing it.
She likes doing it, so she's, yeah.
She's good at it, she likes doing it, you know, and I'm good at it too, but I don't always like doing it. That's the truth of the matter. I like having help, and my husband would think I'm fine. So unless I communicate with him, you know what, I really need help, and I'm not inclined to do that because I'm always, you know, getting things done. He's a P and I'm a J. Well, he kept looking at me last night. He was sitting in the front when I was sitting behind him, and he kept looking at me, and I kept looking at him. We were laughing, you know, because he's so a P. I mean, my husband wouldn't have put the thing together because, you know, I mean, it was just, he didn't have time, you know, he was doing something else. Anyway, so ignorance, but ignorance is an issue because if something were to happen to your wife, could you just pick up? Now, my husband, I've tried to tell him, and he really is truly not interested, and I've tried to tell him, so I have files that I put together for him, you know, and I've told the neighbors, you know, check on the kids because I know they'll be eating, but they'll be eating Cheetos, you know, stuff like that. But in your family, that's an issue. So the partnering, the really understanding of what you have is important. Because we don't know how long our time here is. I've seen people, I had a dear friend who died at 33, left three children. My mom died at 55, and you know, we thought she was going to live to be very old because that was longevity was in her family. We don't know. So, again, having that conversation. Did you want to say something else about that?
Good file systems. I mean, whoever's doing that kind of thing, keep good folders, mm-hmm. binders, whatever.
Right.
Where the information is.
Right.
So that's that. I can go in there and look.
Good. Good. I also think, I know with my husband, even though he's not interested, he has a perspective that's very different than mine. And so if we're making a significant decision, money decision, I will always ask him his opinion because he always brings up something that I hadn't thought of. You know, I hadn't even, usually something quite simple that I hadn't even dawned on me that makes it that much better. So having the conversation continues to be an important thing. Another big one, and I see this more with men, pride or ego. What I see more with men is that they, women will admit, hey, I'm ignorant, and sort of hide behind that. Hey, I'm ignorant, I don't know anything, and you know, somehow that's okay. Men will not admit sometimes that they do have really don't know what they're doing and really do want help, but somehow can't ask for help. I have a situation, I shared this last week, but there's, before I came here, clients I have, she's a vice principal for a middle school in our area, and he is a teacher, been in the district many, many years. And he recently inherited a considerable amount of money from his father, and he took a good percentage of that money and he put it into the stock market, and the account went down by about half. Now, the wife, in her mind, she thinks that's not really my money. Well, they're married, and it did come from his family, but it's their money. I think that's a dangerous place to go, and I really encourage people, you know, if it is, in fact, your money, then it is your money, and that's how you talk about it. You don't say his money or her money or my, you know. Anyway, so they came to me, and interestingly enough, my belief about the reason they came to me was because he needed a way out. And it was an easy, he sort of said to me, my wife really needs help with this. She's not interested in it. If it were up to me, I wouldn't be here. Of course, he's the one who made the phone call. And I just want my wife to feel a little better. So we go through all of their things, and I sit down with them to make my recommendations. And I really thought hard about this. I thought, how am I going to share with him that he's really gambling with this money? He doesn't know what he's doing. He really doesn't. He has, I got this tip from this friend, neighbor works across the street, and you know, this kind of stuff. So anyway, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that if the market's going up and his portfolio's dropped by half, there's something wrong there, right? So the conversation we had was, I tell you what, you have a need, and you get pleasure from doing this, you know, E-Trade thing, and that's great. So why don't we take a portion of this money, and why don't you play? You know, why don't you do the thing that you think, and maybe you'll make $1 million, and that would be great. The rest of it, why don't we take that and make sure it's going to be there for you 20 years from now when you need it? And he looked at his wife, and he said, she did that very diplomatically, recognizing the entire time that really, I believe now in retrospect, having observed them, that he really wanted this kind of help, but didn't quite ego-wise know how to say, I need this help. It was too hard for him. So he was able to save face and still have, you know, the feeling that he was doing something and it was important, and yet now his wife is like, phew, you know, I will be okay now because my husband isn't going to really be gambling with all of this money. And I don't know if you all saw, there was a 60 Minutes thing maybe a month ago on e-trading on the internet. And there was a did any of you see this? It was fascinating. This gentleman had taken, I can't remember how much money, but he had lost it all and then some because he was day trading and he was addicted to it. And, you know, there are some that are as low as maybe $8.95, something like that, a trade, and then most of them are somewhere around $20, $25 a trade. Well, if you make 50 trades a day, it doesn't take long to rack up a ton of trading. He ended up owing $120,000 in trading fees. And, of course, he margined, which means you borrow money to buy stock. And so he lost everything. He just basically lost everything. This is going to happen more and more and more. You're going to see people really get into trouble because it's very addicting. Mm-hmm. Getting on the internet. I mean, how many of us love our internet? I was talking to a woman before I came here having an ice cream, and she said the thing I would miss most if I ever came up here and lived was my internet connection. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm the internet's too slow for me, so I don't have much time. It is way too slow for me. So I'm not sure I'm going to get addicted to it, but we'll see. Another issue that comes up a lot with people is control. When I say control, it is that by being the person who makes the decisions about the money, I control this. And I'm controlling the future, and part of that control issue is that I have confidence that no one else can make as good a decision as I'm going to make. Right? You basically, what you're saying is everybody else around you is ignorant. And so that control issue is also very, very powerful, and I see it in families all the time. I see it, and your parents can have control over you. Your parents are starting to give you money, and they're putting all kinds of strings on how this money is coming to you so they can continue to control. Or possibly people who set up estate plans, and they set them up so that the next generation has to go through all of these hurdles. It's like controlling everything beyond the grave. And some of that's fine. I have no trouble with it. But if you put too many restrictions on things, it just seems to me you have to let a certain amount of opportunity and fate take its course. But control is a huge issue for people. Someone in a family controls the other person or the other situation. You have to let go of that. Nobody controls it. We give it to God. It's our faith controls what happens with our money. Another issue that I see is just a simple one of priority. I am real careful to say to people, I was talking to a lady before I came here, and we were talking about community. I just bought this wonderful book in the bookstore on community. And I've been longing in my community for community, and so I always have some life-changing experience when I come to Holden, and it involves things like a baby, a major job change, a career change, stuff like that. So my husband's very concerned that we're about to have another baby. And I think this time it's going to be that I'm actually going to do something about my longing for community. I don't think it's going to be as dramatic as a baby. But priority. I'm very careful to say to people, instead of, I don't have time for this, I didn't make time for this. There probably isn't anything that I don't have time for. It's that I didn't make time for it. It's not a priority to me compared to something else. I can do anything I want to do if I prioritize my, you know, something else I'll have to give, obviously. I can't do everything. But is this a priority to you? And I'm not suggesting that money should be your primary priority at all. What I'm suggesting is that having an understanding and making this a part of what you do in your life is very important, because it causes us so much anxiety. Now, I don't believe that Jesus said, go forth and have anxiety. So we have to take a leap of faith and some trust. But along the way, some of that, I believe that you have to have some information and knowledge to help yourself be able to release. Your solution was to get the help you needed. And by doing that, and that's taking a huge leap of faith, to find someone you trust to help you with your money. Because remember, we value our money. We value our money so much. In some cases, we value it more than we value our children. Shocking to say, but that's the truth. So you decided, I'm going to take a leap of faith, and I am going to say, I believe that this person will help me. I trust them. And that's also something that I believe prayer really helps with. You know, I'm a great believer that if I can't, as I'm making decisions, that and I really believe God guides my life if I ask for that. And so then I say a prayer. I'm just, you know, this is my decision I'm making, and this is how I'm leaning. And if there's some reason why I shouldn't be doing this, let me know. And somehow it seems to work. The last thing that I have come up with in terms of reasons why we have trouble is denial. And denial takes many forms, and that's a real kind of trendy word in the psychology, but the whole concept of denial, I don't really need to know about this, or money's, particularly for Christians, this is a really interesting twist to it, but, you know, I don't have to worry about money because I shouldn't be worried about money, or I shouldn't be thinking about money because as a Christian, I should believe that God will provide for me. Now, some of you may disagree with that, and that's fine. This is where I have trouble with that, you know, that philosophy that somehow unless you really are separate from this world, unless you really have separated yourself from the responsibilities that the rest of us have in the world, and some people are able to do that, whether you are in a life of service like Mother Teresa or something like that, she clearly was able to separate herself from that. But Mother Teresa was an amazing fundraiser. Amazing. I mean, how could you set up something like that in Calcutta, of all places? She was an amazing fundraiser, and she told her story to everybody, and she asked everybody. So for us, again, good stewards would be, what do we do with our money to, in my mind, be able to help other people? If I get a lot of money, if I inherit a lot of money, or I make a lot of money, then that gives me more opportunity to give it away and to help other people. So am I being a good steward? Am I being faithful? Am I being a Christian? You bet I am. And I'm being more, I'm doing more for it than doing nothing. And also, you know, that my conversation with this woman who got all this money, in her mind, and this was very interesting to me, and I shared this, but to reiterate, somehow by having money, she was less virtuous. I think that's that leap is too far for me. Virtue has nothing to do, in my mind, with how much money you have. It has to do with how you live your life and how you model and live a life of faith.
Well, it's probably because all of the scriptures that talk about you have two coats, give one away. So I see how you can feel that because of some of the things Jesus says in parables.
Right, and you know, there was a book, and it's not in the bookstore anymore, but the book that I brought for folks, and it's been sold out, is a book called The Millionaire Next Door. If any of you, it's in bookstores, and I would encourage you to get it. But there was a study done by these gentlemen who interviewed millionaires, and what you'd be surprised to know is that it's not what we think. These people live, no one in their study had spent more than $400 on a suit in their life, and the most common credit card they had was JCPenney. Now, we wouldn't think that. I live in Southern California, and there's a lot of wealth in Southern California, particularly in the entertainment industry. A lot of people in our community live and work for the entertainment industry, and there's a lot of money that goes through that industry. Many of those people that you see driving the expensive cars and wearing the watches and having the suits are basically living on credit. Most of the luxury cars you see on the road are leased. And a lease is nothing more than a rental, basically. I mean, you don't own anything. You're just paying the bill. You know, there's no ownership there. It's like paying your electric bill. They live far beyond their means. And to me, if you want to call it sin, that would be it. That we live beyond our means. This whole week I've been sharing with people, if you live on 80% of what you earn, you will always be financially prosperous. 10% of it you should save, and 10% of it you should give away. And here's another huge leap of faith. If you start feeling anxiety about money, and you think, God, you know what, I don't think we're going to have enough. You know what you do? You reach into your pocket and you give some away. Now you say, my, what if I only have $5? Why should I be giving away half of it? Because that is where your faith, that is a direct exercise of your faith. I believe that God will take care of me. Therefore, this last bit that I have, I'm going to give a portion of it away. And I found personally in my life that when I give, when my husband and I started giving and giving regularly, what do you give to? It doesn't have to, I mean, I believe we give to our church, we give to the university, we give to the arts, we give to community causes, we give to many different things. And all of them in my mind are part of that giving. But when we started giving, I stopped having anxiety about money. It's amazing. Of course, being married to my husband, you know, if you have someone who's completely doesn't care about something, it's really hard to make them care. So that has helped me as well, because he could care less. And I'm sure that's mellowed me out in that way, because I tend to be a person who worries about things and stews about things and has to solve the problem. I'm a problem solver by nature. But that also, that act of faith is very, very important. Very important. So the way we deal with our emotions is by releasing it, by giving it, saying, God, I can't do this. I am not in control. And I tell my 8.5-year-old, who's the oldest child, she always wants to be in control of everything. She's always telling everybody what to do. We call her Bossy Pig at our house. And I say to her, I didn't put you in charge, and if I were you, that's not a place I'd want to be. I didn't give you that control. You know, I'm not asking you to control everything. I'm not asking you to take charge, because that's a lot of responsibility. Looks at me like, you know, Kai, I know I really don't want the responsibility. Well, you have it, because the rest of us are just watching you take charge. Well, it's the same thing we do. We do the same thing. We're not giving it to God, and we're not saying, you know what, God, I can't control this. I can't manage this. but with your help, I can make some good decisions, can make a difference. Where did my little outline go? Questions about this that you have, you'd like to talk about? We've got about 10 more minutes. I wanted to share with you some, speaking of my daughter, I wanted to share with you some particular situations that have occurred with clients, some what I would call case studies. Did you need something?
Yes.
She wants to teach
the class. Yes, we can. Dinner's at 5 o'clock.
Okay.
When you have the bell. Exhibit A. I was talking to a woman last week who had really struggled financially. She'd been through a divorce, which I was sharing on yesterday or Saturday. I did a class on women and money, and women have some particular issues related to money, but women tend to end up worse off after divorce, and men tend to end up better off, and mostly because women are not working in the same kind of jobs men are. I think that's changing, but not for the people in this room, really. It's the younger, it's below my generation. She was telling me that she's asking me about her situation, and so I said I would help her and kind of offer her some ideas, and so she laid out kind of what's going on. She has state teacher's retirement, and she owns a home, and she's thinking of paying the home off, and then she had this piece of property that her father had left to her, and her father had died quite a number of years ago, and I said, well, tell me about that property. Well, it's in Michigan, and it's on a river, it's really beautiful, and my father loved this place. I said, are you ever going to do anything with that property? Do you want to live in Michigan? Do you go to Michigan? Do you have any intention of building in Michigan? I mean, what is this? She said, no, I have no desire to go there, I'm never going to live there, I just have this piece of property. I said, my guess is that property has not appreciated in value since you've had it. She said, no, it hasn't. And I said, you're telling me that you have concerns about being financially secure. I might suggest to you that you sell that property and you take that and you invest that elsewhere otherwise. Invest it in, you know, stocks or mutual funds or something. And for her, what was that? What did that represent? It was an emotional tie to her father. And so by giving that up, she was basically saying in her mind, somehow she didn't value her father anymore.
Disappointing her dad.
Disappointing her father, something.
Being disloyal.
Being disloyal. Now, that is a huge emotional issue related to money, and particularly when we inherit things. So I suggested to her that she let go of that, that it wouldn't be a dad. What mom and dad really want, and I learned this a long time ago about my parents, it took me a long time to figure it out, but what my parents really wanted for me was to be happy. They had their vision of what that meant to me, but that's truly what they want. And if I am really genuinely happy, then my parents will be happy for me, because that's really, they want me to be happy. So I think that what she'll do when she goes back is try to sell this property, and then she'll invest that money, and that money could grow so exponentially for her and be worth so much more to her. And is she being a good steward of her father's legacy? Absolutely. She's not taking this money and squandering it. I'm going to go out and buy myself the, you know, Mercedes I've been longing for, but I'm going to invest this money for my future security. Well, what a gift. And then even the potential that possibly it could be go on beyond her. If it grows enough, it can go on beyond her and be a wonderful gift to other people somewhere and make a difference. I have another client who, her husband died about a year ago, and she's a very interesting woman because her husband controlled their money, and he was a very controlling person. He died a very angry man and left a lot of bitterness behind. This woman used to buy life insurance policies like there was no tomorrow. On him, on her, on kids, on everybody, because in her mind, she was trying to protect and keep herself safe because she did not have confidence that her husband was handling the money because he didn't really want to, and yet he did. He controlled it, but he didn't handle it. Big difference. And so after his death, she had squirreled away. She had, I can't even tell you how many accounts, all earning nothing, basically. But just all these little businesses, and I'd say, well, what was this account? Well, that account was for XYZ. What was this? Well, that account was for XYZ. And it took her, it's taken her, I've been working for about 6 months, it's taken her about 6 months, but I keep saying to her, he's not here. And I don't mean that to be cruel, but you know what? You don't have to hide this anymore. You don't have to hide it. It's really going to be okay. Let's consolidate everything, and let's make it grow for you. And let's make it good, but you don't have to hide it anymore. And her whole mental thing has had to shift, because for so many years, that's how she kind of squirreled away things to keep herself feeling somewhat secure. Okay. So these are the manifestations of the emotional side of money. I have another client who is getting a divorce, and I work with people who are going through that, because I think that the financial thing is so so badly dealt with. Attorneys are not financial advisors, and attorneys have a program they plug everything into, and it is so impersonal, and it doesn't make sense to me. But anyway, so I have worked with quite a few people as they're going through the separation, and going through the conversation with this client about the money, where she is right now, she's very angry at her husband. So she'll say things to me like, I don't care if he has to pay me alimony for the rest of my life. I want him to have the suffering and the pain of writing out that check to me every month. My thinking goes, you know what? I suspect that your husband will suffer every time he writes out that check, but wouldn't it be better if possibly you settle that right now so that you don't have to be dependent on him, so that, you know, you basically get what I would call a buyout of alimony for spousal support, and you take that money and you take control, and you have, you know, you feel good about what you're doing, rather than continuing to think that somehow you're going to be torturing this man for the rest of his life. Well, her anger has been motivating her decisions. Now, the good news for this woman is she's been going to a counselor, and this counselor's been dealing basically the same things I'm telling her. You got to get over this anger. You're going to make bad decisions about your money if you continue to be so angry. I understand your anger. I'm not saying it's not normal, but I'm telling you, good conscience, you need to get a little further away from this, a little further down the road, and have dealt with some of this anger before you start making decisions. We do this all the time with our money. We make a decision in the heat of the moment. We do it with other things too, not just money. We make a decision in the heat of the moment. Mom and dad and the other thing is that sometimes we have to make the decisions very quickly, like with a death. You know, you have to make a decision on certain estate planning issues within 9 months of the death. The government wants their money, so you have to make a decision about what asset you're going to liquidate or not. So sometimes time frames are thrown upon us, but very often it's just our choice about our decision, when we're going to make the decision. We have to be ready to make the decision, but we can't wait so long that it moves into the procrastination mode. I'm not ready yet. It's been 14 years and I'm just not ready yet. Well, then that's procrastination. But 3 months, that's not procrastination. Sometimes we try to push decisions more quickly as well. So those are the kinds of things, and those are just simple examples, but every single person I have who comes into my office has some issue that is emotional related to money. The fears, the anxieties, the conflict in the relationship, the difference in the way we view things, perceptions, they're all real. And my solution for that is that you get in touch with it. That you really spend some time thinking about why it is you're not where you want to be financially, and that you resolve it. Whether you have more money than you need and you feel guilty about that, or whether you don't have as much as you'd like, or whether you're concerned about, you know, every one of us has different goals in this room, different financial goals, but that you somehow come to a peace about it and recognize, just as anything in your life, you know, whether it's relationships or it's God or it's any other thing, that you have certain stuff that you bring to the table, and you have to resolve that within yourself. And then you can have peace about it because you accept. You're going through the acceptance. Accepting that this is the concern. I mean, I had to learn about myself that my fear was that money would have power over me somehow and control me into unhappiness. It would just swoop me along and I would be unhappy my whole life. Well, that is, couldn't be more ridiculous, but it's real internally for me. And I struggle with it all the time. It's not something that ever goes away. But I've learned to manage it, just like anything else. Any questions that you have or thoughts that you'd like to share? Is this helpful to you in thinking about money? Is it helpful? Mm-hmm. If it's not, you can go. No, I'm just kidding. we have a time. If there's any particular question you'd like to ask or comment you'd like to make, we have a couple minutes here. Anything?
What is it you do for the airlines?
I don't do anything for the airlines.
Or is it for the American Express?
I am a financial advisor with American Express Financial Advisors. That's my profession.
And that's the umbrella organization you work for?
Right. I see. It's an independent, I have an independent practice, but you have, when you are a broker, a stock broker, you have to have your license somewhere, and that's who holds my license.
I see.
You talked about pride, and one of the things in you, I think that may be where this falls under, and that's kind of someone coming to you for financial advice. I think often, just in our case maybe, you may think you do not have enough to speak with someone about your affairs.
That's a big question, and I get the question all the time, who should go to a financial advisor, and who's out there. There are really three types of financial advisors. There's what I call a product person. Your typical old-fashioned stockbroker buys and sells. They trade. That's how they earn their living. They buy security, sell security, they make a commission for doing it. Or an insurance, life insurance salesperson. They sell a particular, what they call product. And their earnings come through commissions. The second kind of person that gives, and everybody, by the way, in the marketplace today says they're a financial advisor. So that makes it even more confusing for everybody out there. The second kind of person is what I call a fee-only planner. That person, you pay them an amount of money, a couple thousand dollars, they put together a plan for you and then you go implement that plan. Some people, that's what they want. They're what I call a do-it-yourselfer. All they really want is for someone to evaluate and review and to give them guidance and they can go off and do it on their own. Great. The third type of advisor is someone that charges a fee, a smaller fee for planning, does an actual financial plan, and then helps you implement it. So you have a partner with you as you go along. And all three of those are available in the marketplace today. And the question of how you find them, my best advice about that is to ask people. You know people who have financial advisors. You may think that you don't have enough. What a financial advisor is going to look for is they're going to look for commitment, first and foremost. If someone is not committed to the program, which is really saving and investing, then you know, I no matter how much money they have, I can't help them. It doesn't matter how much money they have. Financial advisors can work with someone who's putting away as little as $300 to $400 a month. So it's not like you have to have an enormous amount of wealth. If you don't even have that much, then what I would say to you is you start by putting aside. You can invest in mutual funds for as little as $50 to $100 a month. And how do you pick them? Well, there's lots and lots of resources to help you pick them. But what I would say is you find, you know, there's, again, talk to people, but there are many fund families, and you get into the family, and then you can buy and sell within that family. But you start out, because it really doesn't take long if you're doing it consistently before you have a little nest egg that you could then take to an advisor who might be able to do better with it than you've been able to do. It also gives you some confidence. I had a lady come up to me in a session this last week and say, I don't know if my financial advisor is doing the right thing for me. Could I hire someone to give me a second opinion? And my question is, people ask me that all the time. My question always is, do you have any reason to suspect this person isn't doing right by you? Well, no, not really, except that sometimes I just feel that maybe he's doing something that benefits him more than it benefits me. So my suggestion to this woman, my answer was, you know what, if you go to a financial advisor, I have my bias and the way I invest and the way I believe you should invest. I don't believe at all for the moment, though, that there aren't other people who have great ways of investing that's different than the way I do it. I'd be a fool to think that. So what am I going to tell you? I'm certainly going to find a flaw in what this gentleman's doing. I mean, there isn't any way I'm not, because I'm completely different than this person, and I'm going to look at it and say, well, I would be doing this or I'd be doing that. Is it better or worse? I don't know. I might, I mean, unless it's really obvious, it might be better. So I suggested to her that she start asking him questions. And things like, as he calls her to make an investment suggestion, she says something like, why are you suggesting that for me? How do you think that fits in with all my other investments? What do you think is going to be the long-term horizon on this investment? Are you planning to sell it a year from now? So all of a sudden now, this guy, you know, who's been kind of doing everything for her, and she feels probably her biggest issue is that he's probably non-communicative. That's the biggest thing I hear about financial advisors, they never talk to you. Now, all of a sudden, guess what? He's going to be working harder for her. Because when he calls her now, the next time, he's going to have those answers, because he's not going to have them when she asks him the first time. He won't have them. Not because he hasn't done the work, but because he won't have it in front of him, because she's never asked the questions before. So now all of a sudden he's going to say, well, you know what, I'll call you right back. Boom. He'll call her back. So now every time they have the conversation, she's going to ask the questions. And they're simple questions to ask. She wants to be reassured. If she finds that he's not able or willing to do that for her, then she probably has the wrong financial advisor. People can give you good financial advice, but if you're longing for a relationship and you don't have it, then you don't have the right financial advisor. I talk to people all the time who feel that they don't have the relationship they're looking for with their advisor. So to me, if you're going out and really trying to find someone, you look for someone that you trust. And it would be very, you know, maybe you can share some ideas, but the notion...
Lutheran Brotherhood is who I go to.
Okay.
And I trust them. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So Lutheran Brotherhood is one. There's a lot of financial advisors out there, lots of them. But getting some help, Lutheran Brotherhood in particular will actually any financial advisor will meet with you at no cost for an initial consultation. So if they don't feel that you're the right kind of client for them, they'll let you know that, and you can also get a feel about it. But usually financial advisors, unless they're stockbrokers, don't have minimums. Or maybe they do. I mean, if you estate planning companies, that sort of thing really do, because their issue is dealing with some bigger net worth kinds of things. But does that help? Other questions or comments? Thoughts? I'm here until Friday. So I'm happy if you want to catch me in the village and have a conversation. I'm more than happy to do that, and I won't charge you a lot.